right. Wow. Hi. Thanks, guys. My name is Chris, and I am an alcoholic. And first, I'd like to thank Dave for asking me to speak here, and I'd like to thank the group for having me come out. It's always an honor and a privilege to get to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor points out, he says, man, think about if you're out in the bar and, you know, and everybody was drinking, and you got everybody's attention for a minute. You say, hey, guys, if I have everybody's attention, I'd like to tell my story for about 30 minutes. You know, what kind of response you think you'd get? So just something to think about, I guess. But anyway, my sobriety date is June 18th, 2008, and I have a sponsor. I sponsor others, and my favorite color is red. I just repeat what other people say, and people, I come to Florida, and people say that, and so, you know, I figured I'd add to it, you know, always going to improve on things, right? I'm a member of the world-famous Monday Night Speakers group. All right. Oh. And, which, by the way, what can you guys tell me what time I need to finish up by? Okay, thank you. So anyway, in a general way, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. That wasn't meant to be funny. All right, no. I grew up in Northeast Ohio, and I come from a really good family. And to the best of my knowledge, there's no alcoholics. As far as my mom and dad are not alcoholic, my sister is not an alcoholic. Grandparents on both sides of the family are not alcoholic. Aunts, uncles, cousins. As far as I know, I'm the only alcoholic in the family. So, you know, I really can't blame my alcoholism on anybody. And it's just who I am. It's, you know. And today, it's a matter of, you know, thank God I'm an alcoholic because, you know, it's forced me to. Well, first it brought me into the program, and it got me in a relationship with God, and you know, to practice these principles in all our affairs, these, you know, spiritual principles that we're taught here and to live by. There's no way I would do that if I didn't have to, you know, like. I had a good friend when I used to live in Louisville, Kentucky, named Matt Capitelli, and Matt won't mind me breaking his anonymity because Matt's not in AA. And I don't think he would ever need this. But Matt was a friend of mine who had God in his life. And, you know, he never would push it on anybody. But when I'd ask him about it, you know, he'd always he'd tell me about, you know, what he had in his life and his relationship with, you know, his higher power. And Matt always had this peace to him. And, you know, during all my craziness and in my drunkenness, you know, we'd talk and when I first read in We Agnostics, it says something to the effect of, you know, we might see other religious people and think, surely, you know, I wish I had what that man has, but surely, you know, I can never achieve that. I'm paraphrasing, but it's something to that effect. And I thought of Matt the first time I read that. And, you know, so I always knew, because my whole life there was just something wrong with me. I come to later find out, Carl Jung, I believe, is the one that said that alcoholics, in his opinion, have a longing for God. And, that's definitely been, you know, my experience. I can remember when I was around 19, just, like, trying to figure it out. Like, what's the deal? Like, why am I here? You know, and I don't know where any of that came from. And I can remember just being, like, fearful and just, you know, scared and, you know, the impending doom. And that was early on in my alcoholism. And But anyway, I'm delighted that I'm an alcoholic today because, you know, we come in AA and we have this wonderful program to live by. And it's actually, you know, the thing I've been looking for my entire life. You know, it's pretty much, you know, solution to basically all my problems. So anyway, I'll tell you a little bit of what it was like growing up. Like I said, I come from a really good family. My father, I love sharing this at AA meetings. My dad, to this day, if you go home to my parents' garage in Hubbard, Ohio, and if you go in the refrigerator in the garage, right now there's probably a case of Miller Lite beer in there, and it's my dad's. My dad drinks on the weekends, and ever since I can remember, my dad always drank on the weekends, and you know, he'd be watching NASCAR or some football game on or something, and he'd be having his beers, and when I got into drinking, you know, when I was about, now I guess 19 or 20, and I started drinking pretty regularly, I noticed that from the beginning, I always drank to get drunk. Like, I didn't think there was any other reason to drink. Like, I never understood why you would have a couple of, you know, a couple of beers after work or anything like that. And so I knew how I drank. And when I noticed my dad drinking his beer on the weekends, I started to notice I would never see my dad drunk, like, ever. So one time I asked him, I said, Dad, how many beers do you drink, you know, when you drink? And he goes, well, he goes, I have about 3 or 4, and I start to feel it, and I stop. Oh, and I remember thinking, why would you ever do that? Like, what's the point of that? And it was funny, when I went home for Christmas last year, I was telling my dad that story, and he goes, oh, Chris, he goes, I drink more beers than that. He's like, I've been known to have, you know, like 6 or 7. And I'm like, and how long is the time frame? He goes, like 4 or 5 hours. I'm like, Dad, you don't qualify. Come on now. but anyway, and you know, and I remember thinking when he told me that, I remember thinking, why would you ever do that? Why defeats the whole purpose? But I thought, well, that's my dad, and that's how he drinks, and he's my dad, so he's different, and he doesn't count, you know. So as a, you know, a teenager would think, I guess. But anyway, first time I was drunk in my life, it was I was a junior in high school, and I was 16 years old, and I went down to visit my sister, who was 4 years older than me, and she went to Ohio University. Now, I've heard, I was just talking to someone the other night who went to Ohio University, not Ohio State, but it's OU, it's in Athens, Ohio, and they claim to be like the biggest party college like in America. But then again, like, I think like every college claims to be that, you know? Like, hey, like Playboy rated us like number one party school in all the country. But so anyway, this is supposed to be like a known party school. They had this event. It was called Little Siblings Weekend. And I remember seeing a flyer for it. My sister brought it home. And it was like in the upcoming months. It was in February. It was Valentine's Day weekend, I remember. And you know, and I remember, I didn't know, like, she's like, you want to come to this? It's like a little sibs weekend. You know, if you have an older sibling, you come. And I didn't know why. I thought it was like, I don't know if it was going to be like this event where they have like little organized like games and you like sock hop or something. I didn't, because I remember that's what the flyer looked like. It was like a cartoon picture of like a little kid on it. And I was like, little sibs weekend. I was like, all right, whatever. So I signed up and I took a bus down there. And again, like, I didn't know what to expect. And when I get there, my sister picked me up at the bus station, and basically it was just dropped off in the middle of college town. And I remember it was a Friday night, and my sister lived in a sorority house, and which was, I was 16, you know, so that was awesome. And we just start, you know, you just hang out for the weekend at college. So I'm a 16-year-old kid, never been drunk before, and you know, they were just, I didn't know, I was just like, okay, this seems kind of cool. So we started going to parties, and up until this time, I had been at parties in high school with alcohol, and I'd always be the guy, you know, with, like, walking around with a beer, because it was very, very important that I look cool and I feel part of. I can remember standing at a party and feeling awkward, like Ricky Bobby, like, what do I do with my hands? And so if you give me a beer, and I feel comfortable, you know, just holding it, I felt comfortable. And to this day, I like IBC root beer. It comes in the bottles. And I realized one time, I said, man, part of me likes holding the bottle in my hand. I was like, I'm such an alcoholic. But anyway, so I'd be at these parties, and I'd be like, you know, if I'm walking around with a beer, I feel comfortable. And I'd try to drink, but I couldn't get past the first couple sips because it tasted so nasty. And then my beer would eventually get warm, then it'd be, you know, even more nasty. And I can remember thinking at one time, I just don't like alcohol, you know. I just don't drink, but at the same time, I would always look at like my dad, who I always looked up to and still do, and even more so today now that I'm sober. But my dad drank, and I always used it as an older, like an adult thing to do. And I also, growing up, I used to watch all these like these 80s movies, like Revenge of the Nerds and like License to Drive, and I really thought like. College, like high school and college, was just a big party. Like, that's how I saw it, and I just thought that, you know, that's what you do. So, But anyway, I can never get past it the first couple sips, you know. And but on this night, at Little Sips Weekend, I did. And I don't remember starting a drink, but I remember, you know, the buzz, when I first got that buzz. You know, we hear a lot of people talk about it. And, we're leaving one party and we're going to another one. And I can remember walking down the street, and I got that buzz for the first time. And I remember the group I was with was a little bit, maybe 20 yards ahead of me, and I went running up to him, and I said, man, I said to my sister, I said, Cal, I said, I think I'm drunk. And she kind of just, like, rolled her eyes. She was like, oh, whatever, okay. And I remember thinking, I've never been drunk before. I remember thinking, whoa, so this is what it feels like. This is what, you know, all those, on Revenge of the Nerds, when Ogre, whatever his name was, when these guys are partying, or all these beer commercials I've seen, this is what they're talking about, you know? All those older guys that I, you know, viewed when I was younger, and I really thought, okay, this is what college is all about. And, you know, man, alcoholic tendencies right out the gate. I remember, I got really, really drunk that night. I barely, you know, remember, you know, the night. And the next morning, I was really, really sick. And I had the dry heaves. And, you know, this is before we discovered our hangover cures. And I just like the night before, I'd never been drunk before. I didn't know what was wrong with me when I was hungover. I remember about 4 p.m. that night, I was still sick. And I just felt awful. And I remember going up to my sister again and saying, Kel, like, something wrong with me. I think I'm going to go to the hospital. I don't feel well. And she kind of just rolled her eyes. She's like, you're just hungover. And I was like, oh, so this is what a hangover is. Okay. And so this was Saturday. And I can remember getting ready to go out again that night. And I remember I still felt queasy at night. And I remember going out the front door of a sorority house. And I asked myself, I said, will I drink again tonight? And I thought, well, yeah. And I did. And again, I got, you know, same deal. I got really, really drunk. And next morning, same thing, Sunday morning. And I remember going to Burger King, and my sister had to take me to the bus station and just saying to myself, don't throw up on the bus. Don't throw up on the bus. Don't throw. And I didn't. I made it home. So I got home, and I remember sitting in my room thinking, man, that was, you know, that was it, you know. So I had this experience over the weekend, and, you know, no parents, just complete freedom. And I got drunk for the first time, and I was 16, and I kissed my my sister's sorority sister, who was 21. So I was like, yeah, it was like the best weekend ever. And I also like to think, man, that poor girl, which, you know, I'm sure she didn't feel too good about herself the next day when she got sober. And I remember my sister telling me, she's like, yeah, Deborah thinks I don't know, and I'm going to let her think that I don't know, because she felt really embarrassed about the whole thing. And I like to think if she was in AA, she'd be sharing this story. I kissed a 16-year-old kid one night. Oh, my God, I was so drunk. But anyway, alcohol had entered my life, and I didn't know it at the time. I just knew I had this awesome weekend, and I couldn't wait to go to college. I was like, so this is what it's all about. You go to college, and you just drink and party. And the next weekend, I remember being back at my high school, and I was at a basketball game. And I remember at halftime standing in the lobby and being like, man, I was telling my friends about it. I was like, this is so lame. I was like, you guys don't even know. I was like, last week, man, I was down at Ohio University getting drunk, you know, and now I'm back at, you know, my old boring life. And I romanticized that weekend for an entire year, because I knew, if for nothing else, because it was hard to get alcohol, you know, where I was at the time. And, you know, and but I knew for nothing else, I can go back the next year and for a Little Sips Weekend the next year and do it again. And I did. But between that time, you know, like I said, alcohol had entered my life. And there was a few times after that, you know, people would have parties where their parents would be out of town, and somebody would, you know, somebody's older brother would get it for us. And I always drank to get drunk. Now that I knew what that buzz felt like, oh, man, that's what I was shooting for. And, I, you know, up until when I got sober, the way I would drink was, if it was beer, I would, you know, pound those first couple, because it was so nasty. I never did enjoy, ended up liking beer. But I ended up having a favorite beer. Isn't that alcoholic thinking for you? In Louisville, they had this microbrew company, but and they had a really good bourbon beer. But as far as just like Miller Lite, but anyway, I would slam those first couple and just to get past that, you know, those first. But once you got about three or four, you know, then that buzz kicked in. It was, you know, then they went down like water. And so anyway, I graduated high school and went into college, and I went through. I didn't end up going away. I stayed. When it came time to go to college, you know, people were like, "What are you going to major in?" And you know, that sort of thing. And I didn't know. I've been blessed with. I'm an artist, and I just always, you know, have been good at art. And I submitted my portfolio at my college, and I ended up getting a scholarship for it. So I figured, well, I'll major in art. And so I went into the fine arts program at my school, and pretty characteristic of the way I would do things is just I didn't really, you know, I'd get by without putting much effort in, you know, and I was a C student, you know, even in high school, and if you're not, you know, I didn't really apply myself. But the other thing was, as far as what I wanted to do after college, I had known that since I was about 12 years old. And, you know, so as far as a major went in college, I figured I'll major in art, I'll get my degree, and, you know, I'll have a degree if all goes accordingly. And people would say, well, what do you want to do when you get out of college? I said, well, I want to be a professional wrestler. They said, you want to do what? And so when I was about, I guess, 21, I talked to my parents, and they were like, okay, look, if you really want to do this wrestling thing, you know, we'll be supportive of it, but just stay in school, okay, and get your degree, and you know, we'll be supportive of it. So I said, okay, and that's what I do. Now, for me, this whole, it's kind of like my alcoholism. Why this whole pro wrestling thing, why I wanted to do that, and I have no idea. All I know is that when I was about 11 or 12, I used to watch it all the time, and there's just something about these guys. It was just like these, like superheroes, like, brought to life, you know, and they were just the coolest thing to me. And I was like, man, that's what I want to do. That's what I'm going to do. And so when I was about 21, I just turned 21, and because you got to get trained for it. And I would look around, and I'd go on the internet every day. I'd come home from school, and I'd try to find a place where I can get trained, but it had to be, you know, within driving distance from where I lived, or else I would have just packed it up and moved somewhere. And so finally I found a place in Louisville, Kentucky, that trained on Saturdays, on Saturday morning, once a week. And I thought, well, okay, I can go to school during the week, I can drive down there on Saturday, and I can come back and do the deal, go back to school during the week. Only thing was, from where I live, Louisville, Kentucky was 6 hours one way. And again, here comes my sister in my life, voice of reason. She goes, Chris, you can't commute 6 hours one way every weekend. And don't tell an alcoholic he can't do something. By God, I'll show you. but that's what I did. And you know, I had a dream I wanted, you know, to go after. And and I went about doing that. And I think our personalities, we're extremely determined people, strong-willed, hard-headed. You know, that's why I think it's kind of ironic that, you know, willpower is to absolutely no avail in, you know, conquering alcoholism. And so anyway, and that's what I did. And I started traveling down once a weekend, and I'd make a stop at Ohio State. It was halfway, party, wake up early in the morning, show up for wrestling training, and, you know, drive home. I drive home on Saturday. And it wasn't long after that I started meeting some of the right people, you know, and really, God had me then. He was there the whole time. But I was right where I needed to be. I started meeting the right people, and, you know, and things started to actually work out. I found out I was good at it. There's really no way to tell if you're going to be talented at, you know, pro wrestling. I had a buddy who used to say, like, man, that guy's really good. It's a shame his attitude's so bad because he's really good at fake fighting. I started getting in with the right people, and then of course I also found the guys who you know, started to you know, kind of party like I did, and you know, and man, I looked up to these guys because these guys had contracts with the big, you know, the big promotion, and you know, I wanted what they had. And looking back, it was very similar to sponsorship, because my trainer, the guy who ended up training me, he was 6 years older than me, and he had a contract, and he really knew his craft, and I started to do what he did, and in the long run, I got what he got. Ended up getting the same results years later, and things started moving along with that, and then I went back, and I'd come back, and then I ended up over the next couple of years, I finished school and I graduated from college, and I graduated, and I didn't even walk in the ceremony because you get your diploma in the mail. And I immediately went right back down to Louisville, Kentucky, and I moved down there, and because now I was kind of in the running to probably possibly get signed to a contract and get moving with this thing, and that's what I did, and I went back down there, it was fun. It was a great time. We had to travel all around, and I ended up getting a contract with the company, it was lots of fun, and I was getting to live part of my dream, because it's kind of like I was in their farm system, and kind of like being on a minor league baseball team, and then eventually you get the call up to the big show. So that was the next big goal. It's like I'm gonna be on TV, and the whole deal. Now during this time, my alcoholism, I definitely crossed over that invisible line. One too many is in thousands, not enough. And over the next couple of years, I just progressed to looking back on it, I was completely out of control. Of course, I couldn't see it at the time, and. When I watched Goodfellas, one of my favorite movies, and when I watched that movie, aside from all the gangster stuff, but just the way they live their life, just like no consequences, to me that self will run riot, and reminds me of the way I used to live, and just doing whatever I wanted to, whoever I wanted to, however I wanted to, messed up all the time, like always, and and every now and then I get those intuitive thoughts, like this feeling would come over me, like. You cannot keep this up, man. This isn't right. And but of course, I would ignore it and pour more alcohol on it and move on. And I had one goal in mind. I was like, okay, I'm in the farm league. I'm working my way up. I'm going to get on TV. And because that was so important at the time. It was very important. Again, still extremely that I impress you. And the girl that broke up with me when I was 17, sees I made something of myself, and I'll show you. And I like in Bill's story where he says, I would show the world, I would show the world I was something, or something to that effect. And I had a friend point out one time, he goes, why would you ever have to show the world you're something? What can't you just be? And I thought, whoa, because I always used to think that, I'll show you, I'm going to be the man, And so anyway, finally got the call. I was like, all right, so we're bringing you up to the big show. And I was like, yes. So I've been waiting for my whole life, literally, or I thought. And we went out, and I remember it was St. Patrick's Day, 2006. And I'm just like, yeah, man, everyone knew about it because word travels in the industry. And they said, oh, man, congratulations, you're doing great. I'm like, I know, So we go out this night, and we end up back in my buddy's apartment, and about 2 or 3 in the morning, I pass out, and about 3 p.m. the next day, I wake up, and I'm in the hospital, and I remember waking up, and I remember gagging, because they had the tubes down my throat, and they pulled the tube out, and they woke me up, and I realized I was in the hospital, and my friends are looking down on me. And my first thought was, whoa, something went down last night for me to end up here. It's a strange feeling when you wake up in the hospital and don't remember how you got there. And I remember my friends started filing in one by one, and they all had a look on their face of, like, concern and fear and, relief, anger, kind of. And, and they started telling me what had happened, what had happened was I just overdosed on everything that I was doing. Everything I put in my body, I overdosed and passed out and went into convulsions. And about 7 in the morning, my buddy who was with me the night before lived in the apartment complex across the street. He got up to go to the gym, and when he pulled out of his complex, his tire blew his tire out. So he came over to the apartment I was at to see if he can borrow my buddy's car, and he found me. And just recently, or about a year ago, a friend of mine, the guy whose place it was, who took me to the hospital that night, told me, he goes, man, he started talking. He goes, you realize, he goes, the way the doctors were talking that night, they were saying, like, you know, your friend's probably not going to make it. So, you know, we need to get his parents' phone number and you know, get everything in order. He goes, they were talking like you're going to die. And I guess it never really did hit me. And I thought, my goodness. And our friend Chuck Schult, definitely one of my heroes here in AA. And a lot of us knew Chuck, and he used to always talk about, you know, we're here by seconds and inches. And I remember thinking, whoa, that's my seconds and inches story, you know. And I'm sure every one of us has one of those. And so as a result of this, you know, I started coming out of the fog a little bit, and they reminded me that, I started coming out of the fog, and then I realized, wait a minute, you know, how far has this word spread? Who knows about this? Because this was a Saturday now. That Tuesday, I'm supposed to fly up to the main office in Stamford, Connecticut, and they're going to film our big entrance package. Sometimes they do that to introduce a new character on the show. And, you know, I got to go. And they're talking about, no. They said, no, we got to do, like, heart tests on you and all kind of stuff. They said, you almost died. I'm thinking, yeah, but I got to go to Stamford, Connecticut on Tuesday. So, and now the reason I was concerned about if the company found out or not was because I like how in the big book it talks about the alcoholic has a, again, I'm paraphrasing, but it says something to the effect of gets tight at precisely the wrong time. And the company, the WWE, just put out that week, put out introduced a substance abuse policy, and it went into effect that week, the week I overdosed. And it was like a big deal. It was like a press release on it. And I remember when they came down and talked to us about it, like six guys in suits walked in. It was like real serious, and you know, it was real serious. And I'm like, oh geez. So I find out they found out. And I'm thinking, oh man. So I get a call from the company, and they asked me what happened, and I tried to lie about it. And you know, when it happened, they said, well, we got to the guy I was talking to goes, I got to talk to Vince about you, and I'll call you back. And then Vince is Vince McMahon. Now for me, he's like the guy. I watched him as a kid, and he is the main dude in this wrestling world. And I'm thinking, all of a sudden, I'm like, man, wait a minute, hold up. I was supposed to go and debut on the TV, and now Mr. McMahon's having a meeting about me and what they're going to do with me. And I'm like a loyal guy on the totem pole here. And about a half hour later, the other guy called me back, and he said, well, he said, Vin says you're an idiot, and we got to let you go. And I thought, oh, man. So I got fired. And now that was a consequence. Up until this time, I hadn't really had any big consequences, and but that was a huge consequence. Because at the time, that was like the big, you know, the big deal to me. And man, I remember I left. I got out of the hospital, and I went and I got wasted. I was like, well, now what, you know? And for the next couple. You know, months, I just didn't do anything. I remember that was in March, and then my apartment, leasing my apartment was up in June, and they gave me a 90-day lump sum for my release. You gave me 90 days lump sum, and that was gone in like 2 weeks. And so I had no money to renew my lease in my apartment, so I thought, well, I have no place to go. I said I'd never move in with my ex-girlfriend, but I have no place to go, so that doesn't seem like such a bad idea now. So I moved in with her. And for the rest of the year, I just didn't do nothing. I just laid around and got drunk all the time. By the end of the year, she finally got sick of me, and she kicked me out. And again, I had no place to go. So, man, so I got to call mom and dad. And now I'm 26, and instead of being grateful that today I'm great, thank God I had somewhere to go. And but at the time, it was the worst thing because, you know, I'm this big shot, and I got to go back home and live with mom and dad in the same house I grew up in. And and now at this point, I'm just like, well, you know, what's the point? I've isolated myself from all my friends. I burned all the bridges. the company I had a shot company. The dream job I've always wanted since a kid, and I blew it. So now, what's the point, you know? And so I would just drink every day. I'd drink for oblivion. I'd go down to the Dairy Mart, and we have Dairy Marts in Ohio, and I'd get a $3.50 thing of vodka, and I'd go to Taco Bell and get a drink and dump the drink out and put the vodka in the big Taco Bell cup so I can just cruise around my hometown and just drink. And I'd just drink for oblivion because I just couldn't stand to feel. I couldn't look at myself. And the problem with drinking for oblivion is, you know, you wake up from it. And I can remember waking up in the morning and, like, you know, I'd wake up like 1 p.m. and I'd hear my parents, like, doing stuff because they've been up since, like, 7. And in those first seconds of consciousness, I think, like, oh, God, I got to do this again. Just to get up was a struggle. And first thought in my mind was, I got to get drunk. And finally, I convinced my mom and dad. I said, look, if you help me out, I get back to Louisville, I'll get the job back, get the girl back, and everything will be great. Everything will be just like it was, and everything will be fine. And So we were manipulative, and I convinced them to do that. They lent me some money. I went back to Louisville, and really, for the next year, I just wanted to be around my old friends and do the same thing that I've been doing. And, after about a year of doing that, I thought, man, okay, maybe if I can get off these, because something was still, this whole time, I knew something was wrong with me. And I thought, man, okay, if I can get off these pain pills, then maybe that's my problem. I think I take too much of these pills. So maybe if I go to the... So I went into a walk-in clinic, and God bless her. This lady's name was Dr. Rudemaker. And I just got honest with her. I went in, and I said, look, here's what's going on with me. And this, that, and the other thing. And I said, can you give me, like, a pill or something to, like, help me come off all this stuff? Because that'd be great. And I'll be on my way. And she was like, no. She was, hold on a second. And she left, and she came back in the room, and she left and came back in the room again, and she goes, I made an appointment for you at a treatment center. It's called 10 Brook Hospital. It's right on New LaGrange Road. So if you want to go, they're waiting for you. Now, like it's been said, I say yes when I should say no, and I say no when I should say yes. But for some reason, I went over there, and I had this interview, and I didn't know what this any of this stuff was. And I agreed to send them for their outpatient center, their IOP. And the way it worked was I had 3 days to come back before the whole thing would have to be done again, and the whole process that I just had been through. And that was a Sunday night. Got wasted Sunday night, got wasted Monday night, and got wasted Tuesday night. For some reason, Wednesday night, God absolutely directed, because I woke up, and that was June 18th, 2008. And I woke up, it started at 9. I woke up at 8. I had not been up that early in I don't know how long. And I went down to Tembrook, and I signed a few more papers, and they said, okay. And they brought me into a room because group started at 9. And they sat me down, and they gave me a blue folder and a blue book that said Alcoholics Anonymous on it. And I remember I'd heard of AA before, but not really. I didn't know much about it. And everybody started going around the room and saying their sobriety date and their name. And, I didn't know who was who, like who was running the thing or, you know. And so everybody in there was in treatment. And when I got to the front, there was two people, a woman named Kiarney. And when she introduced herself, she said, my name's Kiarney, and today I make a commitment. Instead of giving a sobriety date, she said, today I commit to help somebody. And I said, okay. And then when I got to the guy next to her, he said, my name is Bob, and I'm an alcoholic. And he goes, my sobriety date's November 26, 1989, and I don't want another one. And, man, when he said that, looking back on it, I immediately got some hope, because I noticed this. He started to gain my confidence right away, because one, he said it as he was an alcoholic, and then he gave his sobriety date, and this was in 2008, and he had been sober since 89. And, as I continued to come back to group, you know, day after day, I listened to Bob talk, and man, there's something about him. He looked good, and he was sharp, and I just noticed him. And but the biggest thing, as he would share, he was just like I was, and I knew he was for real. And he's got 18 and a half years sobriety, and I thought, man, you know, and this place was, they're very adamant that you get a sponsor and you had to go to a meeting every night. And so that's what I started to do, and it introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, right away, I looked around and I thought, man, these guys have, you know, these men and women have something going on here. And that's much better than what I have. And I got a sponsor and I started to work the steps. And, you know, things started to change. And the way I met my sponsor, I remember I was sober 4 days. And, you know, I didn't know what was what. And the first couple of nights I didn't go to a meeting. The second meeting I went to was a Sunday night. I was sober 4 days. There was a guy that worked in that treatment center I went to. He goes, let's meet for coffee. And I said, okay. And we met at this coffee shop, and we're talking. And I remember thinking, you know, why is this guy being so nice to me? And I was like, oh, he probably wants, like, wrestling tickets, because he had known that I used to be in the wrestling. I was like, that's cool. I was like, I'll hook him up because he's been very nice to me. I didn't know, you know, the world I come from was no one, you don't do something for nothing. And he told me about he was in prison and how he got sober and the spiritual experience that he had. And he kept using the term old timers. And I said, old timers? I said, if there's old timers in this A&A thing, then that must mean there's men that have been around for a long time. And I thought, man, and he gave me, he gave me a little, one of those little big books, and he said when he was in prison, that's all he had to read, and that and the Bible. And I remember walking out of the coffee shop that night with hope. I thought, man, he ended up becoming my sponsor, and then we got into the steps, and after about, you know, a few months, man, I remember thinking, oh, like a breath of fresh air. I was like, I remember asking Bob, I said, all right, you know, it was like when Bill had a spiritual experience, and he had to, he asked Silkworth if he was crazy or not. He wanted, like, human confirmation. And I said, yeah, you know, I live in the same apartment, I have the same car, I have the same part-time job that I'm kind of doing. I said, there's no outside thing that's changing, like, that has happened. I said, I feel good, though. I remember he's like, that's God doing for you what you can't do for yourself. And I started to get results. I mean, I did my fourth step. I went home that fall for Thanksgiving, and I was sober about 5 months, and I got to make some amends, and you know, things started to move along. Opportunity came up to get my job back with the wrestling. And that the same guy that said, you will never work with this company again with the circumstances surrounding your release, same guy hired me back. And I was like, all right. And that brought me down to Florida, because now they were based out of Florida. So I got down here, and I hooked up with my sponsor down here, who was from Louisville. Some of you guys know him, so I met him in Kentucky, and we hooked up down here, and just got started doing the deal, and started doing the deal here, and I just got involved with AA down here, and man, so now I'm back in the wrestling world, and now I'm sober, and everything that I lost and didn't get to do, I got it all back and then some, and man, I got called up to the big show sober. I got to travel all over the country, Europe. I got to go to meetings in different cities, all, you know, over the country. And man, it was great. And then about in November, last November, I got a call, and I was sitting in Yana actually at the noon meeting. And every year the company does like a massive house cleaning, and I got a call and. From the main office, and I thought, oh, what are they calling me for? I was usually never good when they call you, you know, for no reason. And after the meeting was over, I called him back, and the same guy who hired me back said, oh, Chris, I got bad news. And he started going on, and you guys taught me here, I've learned the power of acceptance, you know, and I've heard, like, you know, if you can accept something in the moment it's happening and go right to God with it, it'll be so much easier. And so as he's talking, that's what I did. I said, God, I'm taking this right to you. So I accept this. I'm released from this company, and, you know, your will be done. And that's, you know, I got released, and they said, you know, but this time it was completely different than the first time. that I got released under. In fact, I couldn't get off the phone with him. He kept telling me, you know, what a great guy I was, and, you know, and how much they liked me, and it was a business thing, and I was kind of like, okay, thank you, I gotta go, because I wanted to talk to you guys, because the meeting was getting out, and so moved on from that, and but now I was unemployed, and you know, I my whole life, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to wrestle, and I did that, and you know, and now that I was at peace with being done with that. And so I was like, well, now, you know, now what? My mom had told me years later, she said, you'll be glad you have your degree one day. And guess what? My parents were right. Go figure. And it was suggested to me, they said, pray about it and start to write, you know, what you like and what you don't like and go towards that. And, man, it's funny how God works because, you know, the stuff that I thought I might want to do, it didn't end up working out. And I like kids a lot, so I thought, man, you know, maybe I should do something with kids or with, you know, teaching or something. It's, I don't know. So I applied for a teacher's assistant position, and this was in the spring, and I ended up getting hired with them. And so I did that, but it didn't pay very much. So I actually I got a second job, which is something I could never have done, not sober. And so I did that, and I thought, man, you know, I think maybe I want to get into teaching. I thought, I kind of dig this, you know. And but you know, to be a teacher in Florida, you gotta have your certification and everything. And so I enrolled in this program, and I was taking classes to get my certification. You had to have a degree to get in. Luckily, I had that. And but then, about 2 months ago, I had my resume sent in. I figured I could just apply for art teacher positions, you know. Figured why not, because I had my degree in that. Probably wouldn't get the job because I didn't have my certification yet. But I got a call back from this school. It was an elementary school, and the principal, I went in for an interview, and he said, yeah. He said, I really like your resume. He said, that's really cool. What you should do with the wrestling. And he goes, the school you're at now says you're really great with kids. So I was working with handicapped kids over there. And this school I was interviewing for has a special ed center. And so we said, yeah. He said, you know, I really like what we see here. And now, in the teaching world, like what I've been told, to get an art position is very slim, especially if you don't have I don't have my official certification. I have what they call a temporary certificate, and I'm in the process of getting it. I have a couple years to complete all this stuff. So basically, the chances of me getting hired here didn't seem very good at all. I went in for this interview, and I kind of was just like, you know, I prayed on it, and thy will be done. You know, and the guy called me back. He said, yeah, man, he said, we'd love to bring you on the team. And so I got hired on at this school. And so then I'm kind of like, okay, well, I have no experience doing this whatsoever. And but I've been told, you know, just show up and move your feet, and God, take that third step. God will provide the rest. And he's done that. It's been about a month now, and you know, I've been in the classroom doing stuff. But the coolest thing is my main part of my job, and the main reason I'm there is I work with special ed kids, and I do art with them, and that's really cool. And I have kindergarten, and man, they are so cool. I get like a spiritual you know, vibe off them, and because they're just so innocent, you know. Today I was leaving my classroom, and my classroom's outside because they got like pods out there, and I hear Mr. Pavone, Mr. Pavone, and it's little kindergartners, and I was like, man, that's so cool, and they're so cool. But in all this, if you would ask me a year ago, would I be doing this, an art instructor at special ed in kindergarten? I never would have thought of that. And that's when I just got to keep moving, you know, I just move my feet and let God do the rest, and his will be done. I just had an experience in the last couple months where selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles, you know. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-pity, delusion, we step on the toes of our fellows, and they retaliate seemingly without provocation. But we made decisions based on self, which later places us in a position to be hurt. And man, that's one of those things that I've heard before. But I've just experienced it recently, and I thought, my God. Because I've just gone through something where I'm I'm going up against a brick wall, like ba-boom, ba-boom, running my head into it. And my sponsor's telling me, the fellowship, my friends around me are telling me, they said, man, you know, you got to go this way. And I say, Raj, no, man, I think I got to go left. And he says, all right, man. He goes, I got to let you have your own experience on this. And and I come back, and I'm all beat up, and I think, I think you're right. But maybe this time, if I go left, doing it my way, it'll work out. And same thing happens. And, man, I remember there was one day about 2 months ago, I talked to four men in the program, including my sponsor and great-grand sponsor. And I was just curious. I added up their the four of them together had 144 years of sobriety, and they all told me the same thing. But when it came down to it, it was still no human power. It came down to me and God, and I had to surrender it, and you know, freedom from the bondage of self. When you come out of it, and the experience is invaluable because, you know, when we're wrapped up in self will like that, sometimes I guess we just can't see it. And practice these principles in all our affairs, you know. And my life is much better, so much better, when I just, you know, let go and let God. And that's sometimes not always easy to do, but when it can be done, when I do it, it's, you know, things always work out better. You know, His will be done, and definitely not mine, because if things were left up to me, oh man, it'd be a mess. But anyway, I would like to. I got about a minute. This reminds me of my former job, by the way, because you get time cues, and like they'd be like, "Do not go over your time, because you're gonna take away from the main event if you go over your time. You're gonna take away from Triple H." Okay. But okay, and like one of the first times I spoke, it reminded me of like performing, because the guy was like, "Okay, man," he said, "get up there, you get about 35 minutes. Try to finish up by 10 till, and don't take too long to get sober." It reminded me of like a stagehand though, telling you the same thing. Okay, don't look into the camera, face this way. Blah blah blah. Okay. So anyway, my life is so much better today. My life is so much better today than it was, you know, 3.5 years ago. And trust God, clean house, help others, man. That's it. That rings more true and true every day for me. And you guys, with long-term sobriety, tell me it just gets better. So I'm going to stick with that. So thank you for my sobriety.
Todd, I'm an alcoholic. And this is Dr. Bob's last message, delivered at the First International Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous at Cleveland, Ohio in 1950. I get a big thrill out of looking over a vast sea of faces like this with a feeling that possibly some small thing I did a number of years ago played an infinitely small part in making this meeting possible. I also get quite a thrill when I think that we all had the same problem. We all did the same things. We all get the same results in proportion to our zeal and enthusiasm and stick-to-itiveness. If you would pardon the injection of a personal note at this time, let me say that I've been in bed 5 of the past 7 months, and my strength has not returned as I would like, so my remarks of necessity will be very brief. But there are two or three things that flashed into my mind on which it would be fitting to lay a little emphasis. One is the simplicity of our program. Let's not louse it up with Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind, but have very little to do with our actual AA work. Our 12 steps, when simmered down to the last, resolve themselves into the words love and service. We understand what love is, and we understand what service is. So let's bear those two things in mind. Let us also remember to guard that erring member of the tongue, and if we must use it, let's use it with kindness and consideration and tolerance. And one more thing, none of us would be here today if somebody hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to give us a little pat on the back, to take us to a meeting or two, to have done numerous little kind and thoughtful acts on our behalf. So let us never get the degree of smug complacency so that we're not willing to extend or attempt to help, which has been so beneficial to us. So to our less unfortunate brothers. Thank you very much.